From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, October 9, 2008. The IMF, World Bank, and finance leaders from around the globe meet in Washington, D.C. We'll go to San Francisco to hear how day laborers are coping with dwindling job opportunities. And a federal appeals court blocks the release of a group of Guantanamo prisoners, 17 men the government admits it has no evidence against. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Two former Arab linguists for the U.S. Army Reserve have come forward claiming the National Security Agency ran phone conversation intercept operations targeting U.S. citizens in the Middle East. ABC News reports the transcribed and saved calls were recorded at Fort Gordon in Georgia and were often of an extremely personal nature. According to the former intercept officers Adrian Kinney and David Murphy Falk, the calls were often made between service members and their friends and families. Here's Falk speaking with ABC's Brian Ross.
One of my coworkers went to a supervisor and said, but sir, these are personal calls. The supervisor said my orders were to transcribe everything.
The Bush administration has maintained the spying is targeted at those with terrorist ties, specifically to Al-Qaeda. But the stories of the two whistleblowers completely counter those claims. Melissa Goodman is a staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project.
The NSA, you know, is engaged in monitoring innocent communications of Americans. They're monitoring the communications of human rights workers and humanitarian aid workers and service members, extremely personal communications, and that it's not at all directed at terrorists. So I think, you know, what it shows again and again is that whatever you give, you know, the government unchecked power to spy on us completely in secret, you know, they can't be trusted.
Goodman says the ACLU is still working out how to include the new revelations in their ongoing lawsuits targeting the constitutionality of the most recent FISA legislation. In a statement released today, Senator Jay Rockefeller, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said the allegations are extremely disturbing and that the Intelligence Committee has requested information from the Bush administration. He went on to say the committee will, quote, take whatever action necessary to make sure the rules are followed and any violations are addressed. The Federal Communications Commission is investigating whether the Pentagon trained military professionals working as pundits in the media. Peter Granitz reports from Washington.
The New York Times revealed the so-called Pentagon propaganda program last May. The program granted 19 retired military officers turned news analysts access to high-ranking officials and classified information. Some of those officials had personal relationships and investments in private military contractors. The Communications Act of 1934 requires networks to disclose whether information presented to the public was bought or traded for. The investigation may determine whether there was a quid pro quo. Officials at the FCC could not be reached because of Yom Kippur. Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein said in a statement this week his agency will also investigate five news networks that use the analysts. The networks have not been publicly mentioned. It's unclear how long the investigation will last and what the possible consequences will be. Adelstein's investigation may grow beyond the FCC. He urged the Department of Justice to conduct its own investigation. The Defense Department has also begun looking into the deceptions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Peter Granitz in Washington.
A day after dissolving parliament in the Ukraine, President Viktor Yushchenko has set special elections for December 7th. The move follows a collapse between Yushchenko and Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, whose supporters pushed legislation to roll back presidential powers. Yushchenko was unable to build pro-Western coalition support. Both leaders also disagreed on how to respond to the situation in Georgia. The move raises concern with some observers who are concerned the elections will be an opportunity for factions with Russian ties to gain power. Next Tuesday, Canadians will go to the polls in a federal election. Today, candidates are reacting to the release of a parliamentary report on the cost of Canada's mission to Afghanistan. FSRN's Kristen Schwartz reports.
The report estimates that the mission will cost between $14 and $18 billion by 2011, when Canada's 2,500 troops and support staff are scheduled to withdraw. It says that real costs, so far, are almost twice as high as what government has reported. the opposition New Democratic Party has criticized the mission for relying on military force rather than diplomacy and has called for an immediate withdrawal, today citing the high costs as one reason why. Liberal Party leader Stéphane Dion denounced what he called a lack of transparency from the sitting Conservative government. This is the first time that a foreign policy issue has received much attention in this election campaign. The financial crisis has dominated the debate, with the Conservative Party's lead in the polls narrowing as voters become more fearful about their economic future. From Toronto, this is Kristen Schwartz for Free Speech Radio News.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Jess Burns.
The Federal Reserve and European Central Banks cut interest rates on Wednesday in an effort to contain the current global financial crisis. And although rate cuts may grant some global financial relief, developing countries may still be in the lurch. Today at the World Bank annual meeting in Washington, D.C., which includes leaders from the International Monetary Fund and finance ministers from the world's most powerful nations, World Bank President Robert Zoellick painted a bleak picture, saying the financial crisis cannot become a human one, but some say that's already happening. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
World Bank President Robert Zoellick presented a dire outlook Thursday when speaking to reporters in Washington, D.C.
In July, I said that developing countries were facing a double jeopardy from the impact of high food and fuel prices. But what was then a double jeopardy is now a triple hit: food, fuel, and finance, threatening not just to knock the poorest people down, but to hold them down.
Zoellick said the World Bank estimates that economic growth will drop in developing countries and it will feel like a recession.
Many countries would do much worse than this broad average suggests. It would be a significant hit. Over recent weeks, attention is focused on the size of financial packages and on the impact on Main Street. There are Main Streets all over the world. We must look beyond the financial rescue to the human rescue.
But many say it might be too late for that. According to Ayinde Shawaga, a reporter for Nigeria's state-run television, the effects are already visible.
In Nigeria, we're already seeing some effect on the Nigerian capital market, the stock market, even experiencing a depreciation in the value of the stock market. So it's a massive drop by our standards. And so we are feeling the effect. So much has been lost, particularly in retirement funds, which were plowed into the capital market, the stock market. So many have lost their savings.
Shawaga says there's been a sharp increase in the price of staple foods like rice, but he adds the government in Nigeria has stabilized some of the costs.
Fuel prices have been kind of stable because the government pegged fuel prices. The government is putting in some measures, like there's a rescue plan for the stock market. And I think invariably this would pay off, at least arrest the downward trend.
Others fear that the economic crisis will roll back the role of NGOs. Tom Gavin is a spokesperson for the global advocacy group One.org that works towards fighting extreme poverty and AIDS. He says they've been putting pressure on G7 countries to keep up their commitments.
This is not the time for the advanced economies of this world, for the developing nations, to pull back their support from those programs. We're very concerned that the financial crisis will be used as an excuse for countries to pull inward rather than using this opportunity to build partnerships around the world.
Gavin also points out a perennial problem with World Bank gatherings, that many of the most vulnerable are left out of the process.
We're here at the World Bank and IMF meetings to make sure that the voices of the people who aren't here, the voices of the people in Africa, the voices of the people in Haiti, the voices of the people in Bangladesh and other countries, don't get drowned out as we're focused on the solutions for New York and London and Tokyo.
President Bush is meeting with the heads of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and G7 finance ministers on Saturday. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
For the first time ever, a federal court ruled this week that a group of 17 Guantanamo detainees should be released into the United States. All 17 are minority Muslim Uyghurs from China, and the U.S. acknowledges that they face prosecution, torture, and even death if they're repatriated to China. A federal judge ruled on Tuesday that if the U.S. government asserts no evidence against them, they must be set free. The men were supposed to be on their way to Washington, D.C. today to restart their lives. Instead, it looks like they'll spend even more time in Guantanamo. A federal appeals court has blocked the original order, and the men are once again being held indefinitely, despite the fact the U.S. government agrees it has no charges against them. They've been held since 2001. Emmy McLean is a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She says it's clear that the men pose no threat to national security and that the case is simply about the Bush administration's continued assertion that federal courts do not have the right to order the release of anyone indefinitely detained at Guantanamo. McLean explains what the latest decision means for the prisoners.
My colleague Wells Dixon is currently at Guantanamo and has to tell them this afternoon that the good news that he passed on to them yesterday has reversed itself as quickly as it came about, that they will not be getting on a plane to go to the United States, and that maybe they should still believe that there is some end of the road and some hope in the U.S. justice system, though, as he mentioned to me last night when I spoke to him, it's very hard to imagine how they can believe that at this point. So right now, the administrative stay has been granted. We're still challenging the government's efforts to secure a longer stay while they try to get the decision of the lower court overturned. And the only remedy that's available for these men is their release. They should be released. They should have been released years ago. They never should have been picked up. And now is the time to right the wrongs that we've done.
Emmy, what do you know about the emotional and psychological condition of these prisoners?
You know, one of their attorneys said that it's hard for them to think of the U.S. court system as anything more than a debating society. I think that's true for a lot of them. They're really in a state of desperation. They don't think that they'll ever be released. It was hard for them to be able to get some hope that they might be being released this week from Guantanamo and that that could happen as quick as it was going to happen. And now they're back to the situation that they were in before and maybe even worse, having had the audacity to think that they could actually believe that their release was imminent and having those hopes slashed. They're in a really difficult place. Many of them had been in solitary confinement for years. Many of them had suffered very serious abuse. Many of them had been interrogated by Chinese interrogators that the U.S. had invited into Guantanamo to interrogate them, despite the fact that they knew that the Uyghurs were some of the most oppressed people in China. These people are in a very difficult place. It's very clearly the responsibility of the U.S. government for having gotten them there, and we have an obligation, you know, not just a legal obligation, but also a moral obligation to get them out and to get them out soon.
Well, thank you for joining us today. We'll definitely be following this case as it develops.
Thanks so much, and I would just encourage people to seek out more information on our website, ccrjustice.org. The case is called Kiyemba v. Bush, K-I-Y-E-M-B-A, if people are interested in more information.
Emmy McLean is a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. You're listening to FSRN. Maricopa County, Arizona, is one of the fastest-growing counties in the nation, and for the last 16 years, it's been home to Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the self-described toughest sheriff in America.
So everybody in this world knows who this sheriff is, and anywhere you go, just say you're from Arizona. Oh, you know the sheriff. That's the guy with the tents and the pink underwear and the chain gangs. Now they're going to say that's the sheriff that's cracking down on illegal immigration.
But resistance to Sheriff Arpaio's tactics is building, and residents are fighting back.
Well, what I've seen here has divided the community totally.
It's really too bad because it's really dividing the community horribly. It's really making racism just a horrible thing again.
It's kind of strange, to say the least.
Again, it's really a situation where that it's created, on one sense, a fear in the community.
It's no longer
on the other hand,
a political thing. It's us finding ourselves in a situation where we have to fight for what's right. We have to fight for what our community thinks is right.
Tune in to FSRN next week when we start a special series on what some people are calling a human rights crisis forming in Arizona. Some travelers entering and leaving the United States are having their laptops, cell phones, and digital cameras searched and copied by Customs and Border Patrol agents. Recently released documents indicate that the Department of Homeland Security quietly reversed a decades-old restriction on extreme border searches without probable cause. Now there's a new bill introduced in Congress to protect U.S. citizens' privacy when they travel. FSRN's Eric Klein has the story.
Tahir Anwar doesn't know for certain if he's on a list or not.
Every time I travel internationally, I get this. I can't remember now whether it's 11 or 12 times I've been stopped, and I think it's 12 out of 12 times now that I've come back into the country I've been stopped.
Anwar is a U.S. citizen and an imam with the South Bay Islamic Association in San Jose, California. Each time he returns to the U.S., since 2006, he's been subjected to 10 to 45 minutes worth of questioning by customs agents.
All my stuff is being gone through. My paperwork, my laptop, my phone.
Anwar has tried to find out why he's being singled out, but he's told simply each time that he's being randomly selected. He was even stopped after a trip he took on behalf of the U.S. government.
I went to Germany. I was speaking in Germany on behalf of the State Department. The State Department paid me to travel on their behalf. I'm flying back from that trip, and I still get searched. And interestingly enough, all the business cards that I've acquired during my stay there, everything is copied when I return.
They didn't let me go until 5 hours later. And then since then, every time I come or leave, I get searched.
Mohamed Shomo is a technical marketing engineer for Cisco Systems in San Jose. He has also been subject to intrusive searches and questioning since 2006. Border agents have taken a look at his laptop and asked him about specific Google searches. They've brought in an interpreter to verify the Arabic book titles he's carrying. They've gone through his digital camera, picture by picture.
Where did you take this picture? Who took it for you? Where was it? A lot of questions about pictures.
Both Mohamed Shomo and Tahir Anwar called the Asian Law Caucus, a San Francisco-based civil rights organization. Sharon Sinar is a staff attorney.
We find that a large number of people who complain to us about intrusive searches and questioning are of South Asian or Muslim background, but that's not true of everyone. We've also received complaints from people of Eastern European background, from Americans who've been here for generations. Essentially, the government believes it has the power to investigate anyone at the border.
The Asian Law Caucus, along with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, sued the government under the Freedom of Information Act to obtain relevant documents on searches and questioning of travelers. 2 weeks ago, they made those FOIA documents publicly available for the first time, revealing that in 2007, Customs and Border Protection loosened 22-year-old restrictions on the examination of travelers' documents and papers. Rebecca Jeske is a spokesperson for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
The new guidelines that the border agencies are going by involve that they can copy your computer and then they can transmit that information to other agencies, copy your hard drive. That's pretty terrifying because lots of people have their tax information on their computer or information about their health histories. This is very invasive to be able to do on a suspicionless basis, just to randomly pick you out and decide that they're going to, take all the information that you have about you on your laptop.
The Asian Law Caucus and the Electronic Frontier Foundation are seeking further documents from the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Patrol, CBP. But in the meantime, they say that lawmakers need to step in to reassert the rights of travelers. There have been a series of bills in Congress since June that seek to do just that. The most recent, and perhaps the strongest, is the Travelers Privacy Protection Act. Tim Sparapani is the senior legislative counsel with the ACLU in Washington, D.C. His work focuses on privacy issues on Capitol Hill.
This bill would really make clear that CBP has gone too far and that the border is not a lawless area. It is an area where the Constitution still guides and must guide agency action.
The Travelers Privacy Protection Act, introduced by Senators Russ Feingold with Maria Cantwell and Ron Wyden in the Senate, along with Adam Smith of Washington with a companion bill in the House, would force government agents to get a warrant from a judge before they seized a laptop, cell phone, or camera. The bill will likely be back before the Judiciary Committee sometime next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
A large chunk of the debate about what to do about the faltering economy has to do with what allowed it to happen. And this is where the discussion becomes political and partisan. Democrats tend to point to deregulation as the cause, and Republicans blame Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two entities Republicans have long despised. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell explains.
At Tuesday night's presidential debate, as for the financial crisis, Democrat Barack Obama blames this philosophy.
We should strip away regulations, consumer protections, let the market run wild, and prosperity would rain down on all of us. It hasn't worked out that way.
Republican John McCain blames Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Really, the match that lit this fire was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I'll bet you may never even have heard of them before this crisis.
The government-sponsored entities guarantee about half of the $12 trillion mortgage market. Alex Pollock is a senior fellow with the conservative think tank American Enterprise Institute.
Well, Fannie and Freddie accumulated very large portfolios of very risky mortgage loans under their government-sponsored operation. And now part of the reason they did was because they were under a lot of pressure from the government to expand their what was called affordable housing lending.
Conservatives also blame the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977, which encourages loans in low-income neighborhoods that banks often overlook. Pollock says government pressure to meet quotas led to lower credit standards, offering loans that have deceptive agreements. The collapse of Fannie and Freddie this summer led to the government infusion of $200 billion. Congress transferred oversight from Congress and the Department of Housing and Urban Development and created an independent regulator. But Republicans say Democrats, for 5 years, turned a blind eye. And the Republican Party has launched a political campaign around it. Here's a web advertisement featuring an unidentified news-type report and California Democrat Maxine Waters.
Fannie and Freddie was upgraded to a systemic risk that could spread.
Mr. Chairman, we do not have a crisis at Freddie Mac, and in particular at Fannie Mae.
Republicans say Democrats were in bed with Fannie and Freddie. But according to OpenSecrets.org, Fannie and Freddie have given 20% more to Republicans since 1990. And their contributions make up less than 0.5% of the money donated by the entire financial and real estate industry. Tim Westrich is a senior research associate at the liberal-leaning Center for American Progress. Like Obama and many Democrats, he blames deregulation of the lending process.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they were a part of the market and did it were a critical part of the market on the back end, securitizing mortgages, but really, you know, the bad actors were not at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The bad actors were other places in the private sector, you know, making mortgages with very complex terms. And, you know, these mortgages that are very complex were previously only offered to the most sophisticated borrowers in the market. And they took these mortgages and, you know, started giving them out to anybody. Anybody that breathed could have a very complex mortgage.
When Congress and a new president attempt to fix the cause as early as next year, the Democrats will likely support more regulation. Republicans will likely attempt to chip away at Fannie and Freddie. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
2 years ago, statistics indicated that on any given day, some 120,000 workers are either looking for day labor or working as a day laborer. But now that a weakening economy is beginning to put construction, home improvement, and landscaping projects on hold, day laborers are finding their job opportunities drying up and incomes dwindling. In the first of a two-part series, Max Pringle reports on how San Francisco Bay day laborers are coping.
Enrique, a day laborer in El Cerrito, California, just east of San Francisco, rises each morning at 6 a.m. for his daily trek to the front of the Home Depot store on San Pablo Avenue. He said that a year ago he didn't wait that long before getting a day's work gardening, painting, or building. Now he can go a whole day and never get hired.
The economic situation is rather bleak. We're not getting that many hours of work. We're not earning enough salary to support ourselves. Times are very tough here in California. We can barely meet the basic minimums. Things are very expensive. We're not getting enough work here to take care of ourselves.
Enrique, a native of Mexico who declined to give his last name, he said this year he's lucky to get from 1 to 3 days of work each week, paying about $10 per hour. Those working with day laborers said Enrique's situation is common. Pablo Alvarado is executive director of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network based in Los Angeles. He said the kinds of jobs day laborers do are drying up with the housing and economic crunch.
The housing crisis is really affecting
the day labor community. That's perhaps, you know, the first layer of society where you really feel the economic recession. Say workers usually do small home remodeling projects and landscaping, and they usually do it for homeowners. From time to time, contractors and subcontractors come to the day labor corners to hire day laborers as well.
A 2006 study by the UCLA Center for the Study of Urban Poverty estimated that on a given day in 2004, there were over 117,000 day laborers in the United States, with about 42% of those concentrated in the western U.S. The study said about half are employed by homeowners, while contractors employ just over 40%. Mario, another day laborer at the El Cerrito Home Depot, agreed the housing crisis is a major contributor to the lack of work for day laborers, but he also blamed the high cost of gasoline and other essentials.
More than anything, I say the economy is already quite bad, and gasoline is very expensive. There isn't a lot of money because gasoline is very expensive. All of that is a problem with the economy. People aren't spending because there's no money to spend.
Because day laborers usually work anonymously, many have been cheated out of their wages and have little recourse for recovering lost wages. The UCLA study called that a routine aspect of day labor work. Pablo Alvarado of the Day Laborer Organizing Network said the workers have few options when they're cheated.
50% of the workers has had some kind of theft of wage, people being hired and not pay after they perform the work.
Molly Clark is director of Monument Futures, a day labor placement, education, and training center on Monument Boulevard in Concord, California. She said there's been up to a 70% drop this year in the number of day laborers coming into the center to look for work. She said some day laborers are worrying about how to pay the bills.
It is a real struggle for people to survive. I have lots more people coming to me saying we don't have money to pay the rent. People are having trouble with food. It's creating a crisis in every respect. We also have a decline in our membership because people are not able to get work, and so we have had people who are returning home.
Day laborers have been working together more to try and survive the economic downturn. Pedro Freire is coordinator of the Monument Futures Day Labor Program. He said workers are sharing know-how and skills to increase each other's chances of landing a job.
They are helping the new members, and they are making trainings here, like showing how to paint or set tiling.
Molly Clark of Monument Futures agrees. She added that the scarcity of available work has also had the unexpected benefit of giving day laborers time to think about doing things like improving their English, developing different skills, and setting long-term goals.
How do we increase our professionalism? How do we better promote ourselves? What kind of skill level do we need? And that is a very promising development in the middle of what in certain ways seems like just a depressing scenario.
Day labor centers are also reporting that many workers are trying their luck and joining friends or family members in different states. Some have been so discouraged, however, that they're returning to their countries of origin until the economic situation in the U.S. improves. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in San Francisco.
Tune in to FSRN tomorrow when Victoria Martinez examines a new phenomenon caused by hard economic times in the United States, reverse migration. Immigrants are leaving the U.S. and going south to try to alleviate their financial troubles. That's tomorrow on FSRN. And that will do it for today's newscast. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.